Day, and if too many people are still having trouble with laying out the circuit board, then I'll send off those who are ready, and those who are not, then we'll just assess you on that part to do with laying it out. Well, I suggest that's what we do this afternoon. Unless you're not working on the circuit board for whatever reason, then you can come to lab this afternoon. Looks like I'll have to. No, I haven't done one. Do you want one, do you?
Well, I've got...
Yeah, all right, okay. Stub matching, sounds good. How are you going? If you've just got a legible layout, I'll take it over to physical sciences and we can add yours to their...
The board that's... I'd still like to do that one.
Right, okay. I will talk about it after the lecture if you like. I think I'll have to start using my laptop to deliver lectures. This is really, crazy, isn't it? I don't know what's... Is Windows paralyzed? Or no?
There's like supposed to be questions. So, I think. So if you like to give me a question that you can use, like, 5 minutes to respond.
Okay.
All right. Sorry about this. It's really getting out of hand, isn't it?
Thank you.
Right, finally, go. Right, okay, we're going after about 2 minutes of waiting for the computer to come on. In this lecture, we're going to go over in a bit more detail some of the stuff we covered in the last lecture, okay, and extend it a bit. We're looking at in detail the properties of antennas. We're going to define radiation patterns. We're going to look at gain. Have we done freeze transmission yet, which is line of sight transmission? Good. Impedance, radiated power, aperture and received power. Okay. Right. Okay, so in the last lecture, I pointed out that an antenna could be thought of as a transmission line, like a twin wire transmission line, a balanced line, and all you do is you open it up and expose the radiation fields to the environment. Okay. The problem, of course, is that mathematically speaking, this is easy to analyse, this is very difficult to analyse. So they're not the physical intuition of opening the thing up doesn't lead you to a great mathematical result that is of any use to engineering. So you have to deal things with the mathematics as it is. So that automatically leads to the 180 degree fan out antenna, or a splayed antenna, the dipole. And the dipole looks as follows, and I think I had this picture up in the last lecture. We drive it at the source, there are two wires up and down, the earth, or the positive and the negative, it's driven in 180 degrees out of phase, drives a current that goes through the signal generator, indicated by those green arrows, and these red lines here represent the electric field lines, although, interestingly, the arrows have come around in a funny way. The arrow is supposed to point all in one direction, say downwards, at any instant of time, and of course that's oscillating. And you see there's a bit of terminology here. First of all, you can see the electric field is radiated away from this antenna, and I'll show you what the radiation pattern looks like in a minute. And there is some terminology here. When an antenna radiates perpendicularly or in the equatorial plane with respect to its antenna element, you call that the broadside direction. On the other hand, along the element is called the end fire direction. And really, those terms have to do with the basic structure of the antenna, so not necessarily along an element. In the case of a helical antenna, for example, the end fire direction would be that way and the broadside direction this way. Okay. I forgot to bring those antennas, but I'll see if I can do it tomorrow. A simple simplification of the dipole antenna is half a dipole, and it's called a monopole antenna, where it's actually an asymmetric antenna, so that the signal generator drives an earth plane on one side. It's an unbalanced signal generator, such as, for example, coaxial cable, and then the centre pin connects to an element which pokes out above the earth plane. That's a monopole, referred to as a monopole direct antenna, and you can see the definitions of broadside and end fire here, broadside being along the plane. It's just a half a dipole antenna. Now, can anyone sort of quickly explain to me why it is that the impedance at any frequency of a monopole antenna is a half that of a dipole? No idea? Nobody has any idea? All right, it's because there's only half a space there to radiate into. And so it can only radiate half as much total energy. That's all it is. Whereas a dipole is assumed to be in the middle of outer space with nothing around it in any direction. The monopole, for it to work properly, has to be sitting on a good Earth, and that Earth robs it of half of precisely half the universe, so that it can only radiate into one half of the XY plane, if you like, or up into the positive Z direction. If XY is in the plane of Earth, it can only radiate into the Z direction. And there's a typical mount for a monopole antenna. Obviously, they're much more useful than dipoles, generally speaking, because a dipole, you have to get it away from Earth, and that's a big ask. On your car, for example, it's hard to do. And so car aerials, in fact, all types of aerial you put on cars are monopoles, one way or another. And there's a typical mount. This coaxial cable coming into a bracket, and this bracket is presumably would normally be connected to an earth plane, and up the top you have the connector onto which you screw the antenna. Right, Antennas look like linear impedance elements, and I spoke about this in the last lecture. They are, after all, wires. It might be a bit surprising that they have a resistive component to their impedance, which is due to the radiation. But they can also have resistance due to the fact that the metal or the dielectrics that they're made of are lossy as well. And that, of course, is a big issue for antennas, to minimise that compared to radiation resistance. The radiation resistance describes what proportion, what the power, exactly the power going into the terminals of an antenna that is radiated and lost as energy from the system exciting the antenna. But whichever way you look at it, antennas are linear systems. The one thing we did when explaining that transmission line, we did not change the linear nature of antennas. They still obey Maxwell's equations. And so if they're linear systems, you can always represent an antenna as a Thevenin equivalent. And interestingly enough, I don't know if I got it on the next view graph, no. But if this antenna is a transmitting antenna, for example, you would not have an open circuit voltage source there. Of course, the antenna would be passive. It's a passive element. And then you would drive Z. And in order to drive Z with maximum power, you have to have an output impedance, which is of the signal generator, which is what? In terms of Z. Yes, Z star, exactly, the complex conjugate. If this was, this is, on the other hand, a literal picture of a receiving antenna. There's a little open circuit voltage in there coming from the environment that is generated across the terminals of the antenna due to the fact that it's receiving. So if you have a monopole, for example, and you look at the voltage there, if there's an electric field in the environment propagating around the place, the antenna will pick it up. All right. Right, antenna radiated power. Now, it's pretty obvious that if you've got a certain voltage across the antenna and a certain impedance, antenna impedance, it's just given by the usual formula. Okay? That shouldn't come as a surprise to you. Right. Right, the first thing that is particular about antennas is that they radiate electromagnetic energy. They lose energy, or they dissipate energy from the system driving them in the form of radiation. And it turns out that they have a preference for what direction they radiate that power. All antennas are, to a degree, directional. Okay? However, as I pointed out in the last lecture, it helps to start in a simple, non-mathematical approach to understanding antennas. It helps to look at the hypothetical point radiator, isotropic point radiator. The proverbial monopole, some physicists would call this is the real monopole, not the monopole I showed you before. This is the one that that really is a point source. Now, simple-mindedly, one would think that the power per unit area radiated on the surface of a sphere that encompasses this antenna at a long distance away is going to be simply the power at the terminals of the antenna, P rad divided by the surface area of the sphere, 4 pi r squared. Okay, if there were such a thing as the hypothetical point source radiator. However, we know better than that. We know that the energy carried by an electromagnetic wave, the power flux, which is in watts per meter squared, is given by this, where E cross B is a cross product, and that's valid at any point in time. Okay? Right. And there's an immediate problem there, mathematically versus the simple idea, and I'm not going to reject the simple idea for this reason, but the form of the pointing flux suggests that there is no such thing as an antenna with an isotropic pattern. And the reason for that is, imagine that you had a dipole, okay? If there is going to be net energy carried away from that dipole, then there must be a net value of E cross B. If I can draw it that way. The electric field, remember, is perpendicular to the direction of propagation, as is the magnetic field, and they're perpendicular to each other. And E cross B, the cross product, given by the right-hand rule, you'll remember from the electromagnetism lectures, gives you the direction of energy propagation. And the problem with that is it's vectorial. You can't put the electric field on a sphere in a uniform way so that it generates. I mean, this is kind of weird. You keep going around here with the electric field like this in all these directions. You very quickly end up with a problem with symmetry here because the dipole has symmetry in this direction. So the electric field, if the electric field points upward here, it must also point upward there, okay, by symmetry. And therefore, we have a problem when we get up to here. With what direction is the electric field up here? Well, we'll soon find out that it's zero up there, and so there is no radiated power along the N-phi direction of a dipole antenna. And we'll see that when we define radiation pattern and have a look at the pattern for a dipole antenna. So real antennas, they beam or focus electromagnetic energy, meaning that there's preferred directions in which the wave is radiated from an antenna. And that's a good thing, usually. There's no real use of having a perfectly isotropic antenna because you don't necessarily want to radiate straight up in the air in most terrestrial applications, for example, unless you're aiming for a satellite, in which case you can aim an antenna at the satellite. So the radiation pattern of a transmitting antenna is defined as this angular three-dimensional plot. It's just the magnitude of S divided by its magnitude. So you end up with a scalar function of theta and phi, and theta and phi are the angles in spherical polar coordinates. So by that I mean the following. If we have a coordinate system like this, and we're looking, for example, to characterise the radiation pattern along that direction, then in spherical polar coordinates, this angle here would be phi from the x-axis. It is y, x, and z, and the angle of declination there is theta. Okay, and of course, there's no radius vector in this because we're talking about plotting the radiation patterns on a normalised radiation pattern on a sphere of infinite radius. Okay? So that's the definition of radiation pattern of a transmitting antenna. Okay? All right. Antennas can also have radiation patterns for reception. And by that I mean the radiation pattern of a receiving antenna is this same angular three-dimensional plot of the normalised received power when the antenna is rotated with respect to an incident electromagnetic wave. So here's this picture of an electromagnetic field propagating this way in space, and here's the receiving antenna, and you move it around so that you trace out these polar coordinates where the antenna radial direction, when the antenna is facing its maximum direction, which in the case of the dipole is along the broadside direction, it's facing along the radius vector. Righto, so we have two definitions of antenna pattern now. Obviously, the only way you can measure antenna pattern is by the receiving method. What you do is you transmit you can do it by transmission. If you've got an antenna, for example, you have to do both, and you have to be very careful. You've got an antenna like that, you would have to have a transmitting and a receiving antenna, and you would have to move this antenna around on a sphere of constant radius. But there's a fortunate fact about transmitting antennas and receiving antennas. For any antenna, the radiation for pattern for transmission and for reception is exactly the same. Okay? So that if you have an antenna, let's suppose it's a dipole. I'll show you what that means. Here's a dipole. Just sit it there with its axis along the z-axis. With that particular orientation, you can now measure the normalised pointing flux at every point on the sphere as a function of theta and phi. And you can plot that out and you'll get some pattern. Okay. Now what you can also do is have a uniform electric field from some distant antenna impinging upon the antenna as a receiver, say along the x-axis. If you now orient this antenna so that this point moves off zero and varies as a function of phi and theta, and you measure the power received by the antenna, you obtain exactly the same curve. Okay? That's what I mean by power, the radiation pattern for transmission and reception is the same. Is everyone clear on that? Yeah? Everyone's clear? Okay. All right, so here's some radiation patterns. This is the radiation pattern of the power received by a dipole antenna. It's a figure of eight pattern. In this particular case, it's exactly a circle. Okay, this is exactly a circle. It didn't come out looking like one much. And you can see the dipole is oriented parallel to, say, this vertical axis. You can see that the largest power radiated is in the broadside direction, and absolutely nothing is radiated along the dipole. So if you have a monopole vertically up in the air, it radiates most of its power out in the horizontal plane in the equatorial plane, and nothing along the antenna. And this red pattern here is meant to indicate the radiation pattern in the equatorial plane. Now, this three-dimensional graph probably illustrates this better, because obviously the radiation pattern is a donut shape. That's what these two figures are saying, okay? It's a donut shape. Now, this idea of radiation pattern applies at infinity, but that is at infinite radius. But for a real dipole antenna, remember I started drawing the antenna here on the board, and we had the electric field doing funny things. We knew the electric field would have to have exactly the same sign at an equal distance and at the same time on either side of the antenna. Okay, and here's a picture of how this strange radiation pattern emerges. These red curves are the electric field lines. And you can see that as you go out along here, a person standing, this is the antenna's vertical here, a person standing in the equatorial plane here effectively sees a plane electromagnetic wave coming at them from the antenna. A person along here sees nothing at all. And if you go to the website where I have this, you'll find it's an animated GIF. And so it's an animation which shows the spatial as well as the temporal dependence of this electric field as time goes by. All right, so radiation pattern is one thing. For the most part, it's pretty hard to measure. You have to be sure when you measure it that you don't get any reflections from the surroundings that cause you to pick up an electric field that's not there otherwise. And for that, you need a room in which the walls are absorbing with respect to electromagnetic waves. It's a so-called anechoic chamber. And anechoic chambers are frequency, therefore wavelength dependent. And they're expensive. I don't know where the nearest anechoic chamber is to ANU. I think it's in Adelaide. I don't think there are other companies that have them. They're very rare.
It's not Monash.
Sorry?
Monash
has one. Yeah, they're rather expensive to install. And if you've got an antenna, and I know I worked for a company where they had an antenna they needed characterising, and they sent it to Adelaide to have this radiation pattern measured. And so I presume that the DSTO would probably do it for free. But here we go. The antenna gain characterises the radiation pattern of an antenna, and it's probably the only thing you're ever going to be interested in with respect to antennas. The antenna gain is simply the ratio of the maximum power flux density of the antenna to that of the isotropic radiator. Okay? So even though the isotropic radiator doesn't exist, it would have unit be gained if it did, and it has a use, obviously. And so a radiation pattern typically looks like this. Here's the dipole, and there's the maximum B, and there's A for the isotropic radiator. What that means is if you integrate the power flux density around any sphere containing the antenna, you get the same number in both cases, because this is for the same power at the terminals of this antenna as for the isotropic radiator. The isotropic radiator would radiate on the whole less power flux density, but would do so over a sphere, whereas a real antenna would, and this is the dipole, of course this is also a donut shape, right? This is a pretty ugly looking thing if you really think that's a dipole. It's not really that ugly looking, but you can see that B is larger than A. In other words, it concentrates power, because provided the antenna is radiating the same power, if for energy to be conserved, it must be radiating more in some directions than others. Okay? So antennas with directionality, with gain, are useful. All right, so here's how you define it. If B and A represent the magnitudes of the electric field, then the gain is going to be given by that. S max on S isotropic, where S is the pointing flux. S isotropic is the isotropic radiator power flux density in watts per meter squared for the same power, of course, at the antenna turner terminals. And you can represent this in decibels. And, you know, just like with dBm, when we had decibels with respect to milliwatts, when you're talking about dB here, which dB is only a logarithmic representation of a ratio. So if you end up with a specific number like dBm, meaning a power, or dBw, meaning decibels with respect to watts, or dB microvolts is another one, decibels with respect to microvolts, you have to state what your reference point is. And here it's isotropic. We're measuring with respect to the hypothetical isotropic radiator. And I should mention that this formula neglects insertion loss. In other words, if you compare the gain of your antenna, you've made a really bad antenna, with respect to an isotropic radiator, the isotropic radiator is nothing but a mathematical quantity, and it's perfect, therefore. But your antenna may not be. Well, if there's insertion loss with your antenna, you should include it in the definition of gain. And therefore, you don't get the full benefit of the directivity of your antenna if it's got internal losses. That's kind of obvious. But in this course, for the most part, we're going to neglect losses in the antenna, okay? All right, now a bit of trigonometry, because we're going to learn the most amazing fact about antennas. So for those of you who like mathematical rigor, I won't be in trouble for this lecture, okay? First of all, some numbers. If we're going to talk about angle antennas, we may as well get right into it. The trigonometry, by the way, becomes quite complex. And so I've cut some corners. I've picked the eyes out of Krause's book and a couple of other things I've seen on the web. Beam solid angle, first of all, is defined with respect to the pointing flux by that integral, and that's an integral over solid angle. What beam solid angle represents, if you can't see it mathematically there, is the solid angle occupied by the beam of the antenna. Okay, you've heard of solid angle before, have you? No, it's easy to know what it is. Solid angle is measured in steradians, so you've never heard that term before. Okay. It's the ratio of the area subtended by a three-dimensional arc or a cap on a sphere, which is divided by the radius squared. Okay? So if you've got a sphere, back in three-dimensional coordinates here, you have a sphere, you subtend an area on a cap there. If this has a certain opening angle, delta theta, and I'll put out the relationship between delta theta and the solid angle in a minute. This has a certain solid angle omega. If this is r, then the area here, A, is equal to omega r squared. And so, for example, omega equals 4 pi, and we have the solid angle of a sphere. Obviously, because the area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. Yeah, it's called solid angle, but to use it, it's a three-dimensional quantity that's useful only for representations and not for calculations, so you have to rewrite it in terms of theta and phi if you want to do something with it. But anyway, we'll worry about that in a minute. The omega a here, defined by this formula, obviously has the dimensions of solid angle, and it represents, called beam solid angle, and it is the area A or omega, it's actually omega, not A, it's not dependent on radius squared, it's omega, represented by your antenna. That's what your antenna's worth. Okay? It's called beam solid angle. The antenna directivity D is given by dividing 4 pi by omega A. So if you have an isotropic radiator, what's the directivity of an isotropic radiator? Anyone? 1, exactly. 4 pi divided by 4 pi. Any other antenna has a directivity bigger than that of an isotropic radiator, therefore bigger than 1, where omega A represents where the bulk power goes to. So what it means is that most of your power goes out the beam solid angle. That's what the idea of directivity, beam solid angle, is all about. Okay, now here's a bit of a surprise. I'll leave you to convince yourselves about it. The gain of an antenna is given by the insertion loss multiplied by the the directivity. D. Okay? Alright, now let's get into the geometry a bit better than what we have there. Do something more useful. Let delta theta be this opening angle over here, and I'm going to assume that this is symmetric. In other words, this green thing is actually a circle. It's like an upside down ice cream cone. Okay? Alright? And we assume that the radiation pattern has cylindrical symmetry about the radiation radius vector at that point. That's the radiation pattern, by the way, not the field. Okay? Right. Alright, beam solid angle. You can now do that integral. For those of you have you done spherical polar coordinates before? So the sine theta d theta d phi is in fact the representation of d omega in spherical polar coordinates. So on that graph I showed you before, that plot I showed you before of the radiation pattern, where we had phi down here and theta here, d theta, d phi, it's easy to derive it. What we want is really the area on that cap, okay? So let's look at that. We have a radius vector out here. We have a theta there. So d theta, the differential d theta, causes a differential drop in the declination of this vector, right? And so if this is r, then this length here is r d theta. Okay, now let's drop it down. Dropping down into the xy plane, where we have the angle phi. Phi goes d phi, which brings this cap around, whose depth is r d theta, a distance d phi this way. Okay, out of the board. Rightio, but what we need to do is I need this distance here, and this distance. So we've got r d theta. Now what I want to do is figure out how long this is. This is the one that's coming out of this. This is actually a three-dimensional plot, so it's coming out of the board. Oh, right. Well, it's obviously d phi times this length here, and if that's r, then this is r sine theta. Right, this length here is r sine theta. If I now come out this way, I get r sine theta d phi, which is r squared sine theta d phi. And I'm letting r, of course, be unity in this. I'm dividing by r in defining solid angle. So the solid angular area of this, which is the area divided by r squared, right, the solid angle, is sine theta d phi. So that's where that comes from, that differential. And in order to calculate the beam solid angle, we have to integrate phi from 0 to 2 pi, okay, and theta over this area here, okay? And that gives you this formula. Now, provided delta theta is small, in other words, the antenna has sufficiently high gain, then you can approximate cos x by 1 minus x squared over 2, and we end up with pi over 4 times delta theta v squared. Okay? So we have, if you like, for this situation of a symmetric field, and this would apply for a dipole, okay, where this comes all the way around here, we have a simple relationship between the beam solid angle and the opening angle in the azimuthal direction, or the zenith, actually, is called what it's called. All right. So now what we do is we use the definition of directivity, which is 4 pi divided by omega a, and we end up with a simple formula here for D, which is 16 over delta theta squared. And there's a place where that's all explained up here if you want to go to that website and read about this in detail. Right. All right. Now, I'm going to use that in a second. I'm not going for time. But I just wanted to define something that is very important, particularly if you work for the ACMA. Because they always ask me, do you know what this is? Equivalent isotropic radiated power. I spoke about it in the last lecture. Who knows what it is? I'm sorry, this appears apparently out of place. It makes sense to put it here. Equivalent isotropic radiated power. Equivalent isotropic radiated power is simply the power applied at the terminals of an isotropic antenna. Okay? That's what it physically is, and I'll get down to what it's used for and how to use it is what's important. EIRP is often used to specify a legal emitted power limited to a certain frequency. And we've seen that antennas are always directional. They always put more power in some directions than other directions. EIRP, equivalent isotropic power, radio power, is defined so that it limits the allowed terminal power of an antenna so that the maximum flux density produced by that antenna is less than or equal to that of an isotropic radiator with its terminal power equal to the IRP. That's a bloody mouthful, and I find it really hard to get my head around it sometimes. What it means is, if suppose on a particular wavelength or a particular frequency you have an EIRP of 1 watt, that's all you're allowed to legally transmit, and you say, well, okay, I've got a high gain antenna. So you bring the high gain antenna up and you connect it to a 1 watt source. You've just broken the law, okay? Because EIRP is the terminal power at the terminals of an isotropic radiator. So that means that if you put the 1 watt at the terminals of an isotropic radiator, you'll get an equal power flux density in all directions. Remember the picture I had before with the circle of the isotropic when we define the gain of the antenna and that elongated beam, okay? The EIRP power limit states that you have to turn back the power. You're going to have to lower the terminal power on your antenna until it radiates a maximum power flux density, which is equal to the flux density of an isotropic radiator for 1 watt. Actually, I'm not sure that first statement up the top there helps very much. You should be careful about it. The definitions, I had a look at several of them last week on the web, and none of them were particularly satisfactory in doing it in one sentence. You go to the bottom sentence, that's what it's. In its legal context, when you're trying to limit the power flux density of an antenna, that bottom sentence there describes what the EIRP is. Does everyone have it clear in their mind what I'm getting at? Yeah, you do, right? You know how to burn people's eyes out with their antennas. Right? Because you always can, you just have bigger and bigger and a bigger antenna until the beam closes up until you frazzle the fly, right? But you're not allowed to do that. What you have to do is turn the width down on the signal generator, supply that antenna, so that the maximum power flux density in the spot that's burning the fly is less than or equal to what it would be if you applied 1 watt at the terminals of an isotropic radiator. Now, to frazzle the fly, you have to go to a megawatt, right? A gigawatt to frazzle the fly with an isotropic radiator. To do so with a high gain antenna, you need less power at the terminals. And so the EIRP limit says you have to keep cranking back the power. All right. Rightio. We also have another formula for free, thanks to the definition of isotropic radiator. And that is that the maximum pointing flux of any antenna is going to be given by the gain of the antenna multiplied by the transmitted power divided by 4 pi r squared. Everyone see where that comes from? If you've got an isotropic radiator and you define the gain of an antenna with respect to the isotropic radiator, you've got a way of calculating the power radiated by any antenna for which you know the gain. Now, that's why radiation pattern is not so important in this. You can get, you don't have to calculate the radiation pattern of an antenna to know what it's going to transmit in the most interesting case, namely that along the maximum direction of radiation. Okay, so everyone understand that formula? If you've understood the isotropic case with G equal to 1, then now you've just got to add G, okay? And that's very close to what I call, what we'll discover probably in the next lecture now, the Friis transmission formula. The Friis transmission formula says if you have two antennas, both of them aiming at one another with their maximum gains pointing at each other, then you can straightforwardly calculate the power received by the receiving antenna if you know the power transmitted by the transmitting antenna. And that's exactly the circumstance that you're going to use in practice, because you're not going to deliberately set up antennas so they can't communicate necessarily, okay? Not in most circumstances, anyway. All right. Rightio. Now, we've got to a point now where I've got maybe 5 minutes to go, and there's only one other thing I want to say in the lecture before we go and look at aperture in detail. I've spoken about how to calculate the power transmitted by an antenna so far, and that's easy. You know the power you put into it, and you do your matching, okay? And then you just use a simple formula for the isotropic radiator and multiply by the gain of the antenna. So you've got the transmitted power. Now you want to know, well, how much power can an antenna emit as a receiver? It's not obvious that it's going to be easy to calculate, is it? The mathematics behind antennas is always complicated, and receiving is unbelievably complicated. But it turns out with a bit of argy-bargy, you can get a good estimate of how much power an antenna emits. Okay, it's called aperture. That's what the aperture of an antenna is. The bigger is its aperture, if you think of aperture being an area, like a big collecting area, the aperture of the telescope, you may have heard of the aperture of a thermal solid dish, means its area. The bigger it is, the more it gobbles up, the more energy it intercepts. That's the intuitive notion behind aperture. And we're going to look at a dish antenna, a satellite dish, because a satellite dish, the mathematics is easy. And then once we've figured out how a satellite dish works, which is not hard to do, we're going to face it off against a wire antenna like a dipole with the complicated geometry and complicated mathematics, and let reciprocity give us the answer for free. That's the aim, that's the name of the game. Alright, so let's imagine that this is actually a different concept to what you've probably ever seen before. Imagine a planar light beam which is illuminating a round hole on a black screen at normal incidence. From the back here, okay? Now, if this is a hole in a screen and there's light coming from it, intuitively, you know, because it's light, that you'll see a spot of white if you're looking right at it, a white light coming at you. And if you have a dark room and a screen on the other side of the room, you'll see a white spot, okay? Well, it turns out that that's a special case because most spots that we know about are much larger than microns in dimension. That means they're much larger than the wavelength of light. Okay? However, what happens when the spot is about the order of a wavelength? Okay? And what I'm going to be making an argument for here is we have this disk, right? This flat disk, or this spot, and we're going to liken that to our satellite dish, right? At the dish. The dish itself is much larger than a wavelength, but it isn't anything like the size of a normal hole compared to light. It might be 10 times larger, maybe 20 times larger than a wavelength, but it's not going to be millions times larger. Okay? And the other thing you know about satellite dishes is they're parabolic, or they're perfect spherical reflectors, so that they have this property that they have a focus. And so when a light ray or an electromagnetic ray comes along parallel to the axis of the dish, it gets reflected off the inner surface of the dish into a focal point. And that focal point, you've heard of that before, haven't you? Parabolic. The property of a parabola is precisely that. If you have a parabola has that property. There's a parabola, y equals x squared. Okay, if you draw a line parallel to the y-axis, and then you let the angle of incidence parallel to this curve equal the angle of reflection, those two angles are equal, and you do that for any parallel beam. There's a special point on the y-axis called the focal point at which all those beams intersect. Okay? And in the case of a satellite dish, that's nothing but a mathematical trick, if you like, so that you don't have to have a hole in the screen. In other words, all the light collected by the satellite dish ends up as focus. And that's got apart from the fact that you have to know that you're collecting energy from the satellite dish, it's of no consequence to the present argument. Okay? Right, I now suppose we've got this hole in the screen and we've got light impinging upon it, and we increase the wavelength. Well, it turns out that the beam coming out of the hole does not remain collimated. It starts to expand. Who knows what that effect is called in physics or optics? Somebody doing optics here must know what the expansion of the beam is. What is it that limits the resolution of telescopes? Why does the telescopes have to be big in order for them to resolve spots? What's the property of light going on there? I'm sure you've heard of the word. Acronyms, what is it called? Diffraction. Yeah, come on, you must have all known diffraction. Yeah, okay. Diffraction. It's called diffraction limitation of focusing beams, okay?
It's in the air. It's only diffraction
in air. No. This is true for telescopes in vacuum. Yeah, optical telescopes have problems with the atmosphere too, but if you have no atmosphere and you could put your satellite dish on the moon, or your telescope on the moon, you'd still have the diffraction limiting problem. This is why telescopes have to be big, even optical ones, so that they can resolve points. The problem is that there's an opening angle. It's a diffraction effect, and there's the formula for it. If D is the diameter of the hole, lambda is the wavelength, then that my magic angle delta theta B, which I'm going to use for antennas in a minute, describes the opening due to diffraction. And you can see delta theta B is zero. Lambda is zero, very short wavelength, 1 micron, when D is 1 centimetre, and theta is tiny. You're going to admit, but the problem with astronomy is that you're looking at objects that are a long way away. So if you want to resolve two spots a long way away, you've got to get delta theta B small. Okay? And that's the Rayleigh diffraction formula. Right? Sometimes written as 1.22 lambda over D. Alright? Think about this. This is there's a well-known experiment that proves the Rayleigh formula when there were arguments back about 400 years ago between Newton, who said that light was made of particles like bullets, and Thomas Young, who came up with the wave theory of light. And there's this French guy named Poisson, his name means fish, but that's the problem. He said, how preposterous this theory of light, the wave theory of light. What it means is if I have a coin, a little frank piece, right, and I shine light on it, I should get a bright spot right in the middle of the shadow on the other side of the coin. Right? By diffraction. Right? Coins should cast shadow, shouldn't they? If you've got a coin and you shine it with light, then you should get a shadow here, shouldn't you? But what Poisson showed with Young's equations was that there would be this diffraction effect. Here's delta theta B here, right? This is the Rayleigh diffraction effect, the bending of light. That's what diffraction is. And you end up with a bright spot here, called Poisson's bright spot. Unfortunately for Poisson, he did the experiment and he discovered it. He did the experiment to disprove it, but he discovered it. So it was the first experiment to demonstrate the existence of, well, I don't know if you'd classify this as the first experiment for diffraction, because like Tom was saying, you can get diffraction of light through water. That's the bending of light source. That's called refraction. Sorry. Diffraction, I'm not sure. But anyway, this is Poisson. It was diffraction he was looking at here, okay? So he proved that indeed it did occur. And that's what this formula is all about. And for optical telescopes, the implication is you need a large collecting area in order to resolve two stars that are a long way away and very close to each other, or otherwise they blur. They appear blurred when you look at them. Yeah. All right, so this is the first step toward understanding antenna aperture. We'll continue tomorrow.